you very much, and thank you for your patience. I'm entering the brave new world of YouTube embedding in PowerPoint presentations, and so far it's been 100% failing every time I've tried to do it in every context. Every piece of technology has failed, but this is about the most successful it's managed to work so far, so that's good. Okay, so yeah, my name's Lonnie, and I am currently at the University of Edinburgh, and I just wanted to say a little bit more about my general project before I start, which is on questions and questioning in epistemology, so the epistemology of questioning, and in particular looking at how the practice of questioning affects our everyday lives and how it leads to epistemic goods or states like knowledge and understanding. So I'm interested in the role that questioning plays in learning and in education context in particular. So basically, generally speaking, I've been looking at questions when they work, when they go well, good questioning, or the virtues associated with questioning, specifically inquisitiveness and curiosity. So this is really a kind of first step into looking at the ways in which questioning as a practice goes wrong, and it's fairly new material, so I'm really interested to see what everybody makes of it. Okay, so I'll be starting off by giving a quick kind of account of what I take to be bad questioning. I'll be offering a very incomplete taxonomy of bad questioning. Then I'll be looking at what bad questioning looks like in public discourse, and some of the examples from the all-important videos. And then I'll be briefly discussing the conditions that that facilitate bad questioning in public discourse. Okay, so I think the best way to understand bad questioning, at least from my point of view, given where I'm coming from, is to have a look at what good questioning is. So my account of good questioning says that the good questioner acts competently in order to elicit worthwhile information. That's the kind of basic, thinnest account of the good questioner. Obviously, things need to be spelled out in that account, but specifically, when I say worthwhile information, I'm talking about what essentially the questioner is asking, what they're directing their question at, what content they're looking for in order to fill out their question, also known as an answer. So it's looking, when you're looking for worthwhile information, you're looking for an answer that is relevant or significant to your aims and context, and is non-trivial or not vicious. So there's a lot to say about worthwhile content, but the point here is that it essentially involves what the questioner asks. They have to be seeking a worthwhile piece of information. What does it mean to say that the questioner acts competently? That essentially captures the performative conditions of the question asking. So it concerns when, where, who, and how you ask the question. And there are, I think, lots of parameters that that we can sort of list off that dictate whether or not a question, an instance of question asking or a series of questions has been asked competently. So bad questioning then goes wrong in at least one of these ways. Either the bad questioner is seeking information that is not worthwhile, the subject matter of the question is not worthwhile, the answer they're looking for is not worthwhile, either because it's not significant or relevant, or because it's trivial, or because it's actually vicious in some way. On the other hand, they might go wrong because they're incompetent in the performance of their question. So they might ask the wrong person, or at the wrong time, in the wrong place, or in the wrong way. you might ask a 5-year-old child if they're going to vote in an upcoming referendum in a language that they don't speak. That would be an instance of, you know, asking the wrong person in the wrong way. And so on. It's easy to think of ways in which you can go wrong with questioning. So importantly, caveat that I'm talking about what I think of as bad questions, qua questions. So I think of the function of a question as at base to elicit information. And so when you are engaged in bad questioning, you're in some way failing to elicit information in one of these two ways. So bad questions, qua questions, impede or prevent epistemic progress, you know, as opposed to they're just straightforwardly mean along some kind of ethical dimension. That may well be a bad question, qua question, but I'm talking about it qua question, i.e. qua its function to elicit information, rather than for any of the other functions that it might have. Okay, so a quick note about the relationship between bad questioning and intellectual vice. I call the presentation Vices of Questioning. And so just to qualify, really, I'm not identifying vices here, like individual vices of questioning. It's rather looking at questioning as a practice, and in particular as a vicious practice. So really, bad questioning is not itself an intellectual vice, just like I think good questioning isn't itself an intellectual virtue, but rather like good questioning features in a lot of intellectually virtuous practice, bad questioning features in a lot of intellectually vicious practice. It's an intellectual incompetence, features in vices such as dogmatism, prejudice, arrogance, closed-mindedness, and so on. Okay. So an incomplete taxonomy of bad questioning. I'm going to go through these like fairly quickly, but I do want to fill out this taxonomy a little bit, and then I'm going to focus on just a few of these in order to kind of look at how some of these manifest in public discourse. I've put a note to myself to say don't put too much weight on the slogans here. Like, these aren't meant to be, kind of really informative definitions of what I'm calling the different types of bad questions. It's just a way of, like, representing, of trying to capture the information in a very, like, minimal but hopefully informative way. They're not always going to be instances of bad questioning, as we'll see in the examples. And so a lot depends on the context in which the questions are used and the way in which they're asked. I think there may be a couple of exceptions to that. So you might think that unclear or inefficient questions are always going to be bad questions, qua questions, i.e. they're always going to impede or prevent epistemic progress, but maybe not. You might think that rude or aggressive questions are always instances of bad questioning in some other sense, i.e. they're always bad form, bad intellectual practice, but they might not always be bad qua questions. They might not always impede or prevent epistemic progress. Okay, so some of the examples are more obvious than others. Aggressive questions, for example, we can all probably remember instances of aggressive questioning, or you've seen them certainly in public discourse, and we will see an example of that in the small cases. Categorical questions, questions that contain absolutes, so for example, do you always vote Labour? The word always is the absolute, and those kinds of questions are especially problematic in surveys or polls or anywhere essentially where the respondents' options are limited, such as a referendum, for example. unless that is the exact thing that the questioner wants to know, those absolutes should be avoided. Okay, so closed questions, do you always vote Labour, yes or no? Problematic, especially when combined with categorical questions, for example, and also when combined with, for example, compound or loaded questions that I'll come to in a minute, because it limits the possible answers and in a way that could be unhelpful. Compound questions. Do you always go to the polling station and vote Labour? So we've got two propositions contained in the one question. It's a compound presupposition containing both the proposition that you always go, that you always vote Labour, and that you always go to the polling station. And if you're asked that in a context where you can only answer yes or no, you might have to commit to one of the presuppositions of the question that you would otherwise not commit to, i.e. it might be that you always vote Labour, but sometimes you postal vote. But if you ask the question in that compound way, then you're going to have to commit to both or neither. Inapt questions. I've written, do you vote Labour in Esperanto here, but I have failed to find out how I actually should say it, essentially. The point is if you ask a question in an apt way, the point is that it's meant to be knocking on the door of going wrong in the sense of how you ask. So if you ask in the wrong language, I was choosing that because it seemed like it was always going to be an apt. But yeah, didn't work out. I'd say QV, does anyone speak Esperanto? QV voc donas laboron is what I've got here. That's an apt. Inefficient question. Again, the point is fairly self-explanatory. The point is that an inefficient question is particularly long-winded or meandering in an unhelpful way. Leading questions. So do you vote for the best political party in the universe, which is obviously Labour? That's a leading question, clearly, and we'll look at those types of questions in more detail as well. Loaded questions. Do you vote for the best political party in the universe, which is obviously Labour? It's also a loaded question because it contains a contentious presupposition. It contains a presupposition that you might not want to commit to. Misjudged questions. The example of asking a five-year-old, for example, you've misjudged the context in which the question should be asked. And there are lots of dimensions along which you can misjudge the context of a question. Open questions, I've just put them up there. Oh, no, that's the wrong. Yeah, I did put open questions up there. I've gone through most of those. Open questions I put up there because, typically it seems like closed questions get short shrift in this kind of context, but of course you can always ask inappropriately open questions that might end up leading you down a path that, you know, getting information that you don't want and obscuring information that you do want. It might be more appropriate to ask a closed question in some contexts. Rude questions are fairly self-explanatory, and unclear questions, again, fairly self-explanatory. This last one, the wrong question, is meant to attach to the issue of worthwhile information elicitation. So you're asking the wrong question if you're essentially seeking subject matter which is trivial or disvaluable or irrelevant or insignificant given your aims and context. So in essence, the bad questions in yellow are those that attach to the performative side of bad questioning, and the one in blue attaches to a whole heap of ways in which you can just be after the wrong information. Okay, so let's look at some instances in public discourse. Going to look at closed questions. First of all, closed questions, not always bad questions, like I've said. In fact, they can be exactly what is needed in order to start a discussion or to clarify a position, to get the precise information you want, and so on. And there's good philosophical teaching practice that at least I've come across, whereby you ask a closed question in order to force a response, and then you ask an open question in order to get a bit further information on that response. So they can be very useful, but closed questions are bad questions when they impede or prevent epistemic progress. So that's most often the case when a closed question is asked where a more complex or nuanced answer is required or preferable. The respondent is forced to select one of a limited number of options, for example, typically yes or no, and that restricts, sometimes drastically, the information that they can offer. So the little cartoon is meant to be an example of closed questioning, but I wanted to give this more real case. So this is a clip from the pre-election interviews conducted the UK national election in 2016 with the leader of the two main opposing parties, Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, and hosted by Jeremy Paxman on Channel 4. And Jeremy Paxman, for anyone not familiar with British political landscape, is famously hardline political interviewer, really. Anyway, so you'll see what happens here with the closed questioning. Hopefully.
Jeremy Corbyn, in 11 days' time, you might be Prime Minister. People are entitled to know about you, aren't they?
Yes.
Are you frustrated?
Looking forward to it as well.
Good. Are you frustrated that so many of your core ideas, your basic principles, didn't make it into this manifesto?
First question. That's the first question. Are you frustrated that so many of your core ideas, your basic principles, didn't make it into this manifesto? So keep track of that.
Oh, come on. This is a really good matter. I'm glad you got it, by the way. It's a really
I've had to read it too.
Well, I have to write it.
Yeah, but it doesn't include key things that you believe in, does it?
This manifesto is a product of the views of the Labour Party.
You have spent
of party conference decisions and the views put forward by individuals in the shadow cabinet. But this manifesto,
you
fundamentally
swayed the cabinet.
Can I
the shadow cabinet?
Can I finish it?
No.
Oh, come on, give
you swayed the shadow cabinet to accept your basic principle, which you have adhered to for the whole of your adult life, that there should be nuclear disarmament. You promising this to renew Trident.
A conference decision by the Labour Party, and as the leader of the party, I accept the democracy of our party. And
is that morally right?
Second question. Is that the same question as the first one? No. Is that morally right?
Answer to the questions put earlier. I made the point that as Prime Minister, I will do all I can to bring about a nuclear-free world, because I'm horrified at the very idea of a nuclear attack.
You a nuclear weapon.
It's there.
Is that morally right?
Second question, arguably a different question. Is that morally right? But the reference to that.
Listen, it's there in our manifesto because our conference voted for it. I have to accept it.
Do you think
it's
morally right?
Can I finish?
Different
can
question.
Finish? What I want to see.
I'm asking you.
What I want to see.
Do you think it's morally
what
right?
I want to see is a nuclear free world.
Oh, that everybody is, wants to see.
Well,
that.
I'm not so sure
right,
about
it.
I'm not so sure about it.
If
I'm not sure about
is
that.
Is it morally right to renew a nuclear deterrent?
That is the decision that's been taken. We will work for a nuclear-free world.
I know
we will
good.
Work through the...
So, it finishes there. I know you don't answer the question. So, it's a clear case, I think, of really, really poor, vicious practice with respect to questioning. And... in particular, the use of closed questioning. This question is it morally right that he repeats again and again? And Jeremy Corbyn is just trying to give an answer that is slightly more nuanced and complex than yes or no in answer to that question. And he Jeremy Paxman accuses him of not answering the question because he hasn't said yes or no, he's trying to give an explanation. You can see what's going on there. It's also clearly an instance of very aggressive questioning, and I think an instance of really viciously slippery questioning, because he does really start off with a completely different question, and it changes. And even each instance when he says, is it morally right, it's unclear that he's referring to the same thing. Slipping. So it's a really unfair way to conduct a political interview. And that, by the way, is literally the first 2 minutes of the interview. Okay, so that posed an, I think, slippery question. So compound and loaded questions are our second example. Compound questions, like I described earlier, are questions that have a compound or also known as a complex presupposition. So a presupposition comprised of multiple component propositions. That might be a conjunction, it might be a disjunction, it might be a conditional. And a loaded question is one that contains a controversial or unjustified assumption. So compound and loaded questions, again, they're not always bad questions. They're bad and also fallacious at times when used in a way that obscures the respondent's true commitments or forces the respondent to commit to a contentious or unjustified assumption. So a paper by Douglas Walton, who has written on these types of questions, and he gives this kind of account of what's going wrong here. The complex or compound question limits the respondent's options so that he is forced to accept propositions that he's not really committed to and would disavow if given reasonable chance to do so. In a trial or deposition, the opposing party can object to these kinds of questions, and if that objection is sustained, then the question must be withdrawn and asked in a series of separate questions. And he gives this example in the paper. When did you stop cheating on your income tax return? The question is a when question, so in order to give a direct answer, the respondent has to indicate some particular time, like, for example, December 2nd, 1976. However, in this case, if the respondent does give such a specific time as the answer, then it is clear that he's become committed to having cheated on his income tax returns, and presumably this is a proposition which generally he would not be want to concede, or at any rate would be prejudicial or not in his interest to concede. So that's a kind of classic case. It's the when did you stop beating your wife case also. And it's kind of a familiar tactic, especially in this legal context. So again, we're going to return, I'm afraid, to these televised debates and see this in action in the interview with Theresa May.
Theresa May, when did you realise that you got the wrong answer to the biggest question of our time?
That literally is the first question he asks. That's her first question. Classic example. And it's a when question.
Well, I'm tempted to ask you, Jeremy, what do you think? Do you mean that you're talking about Brexit?
Well, of course.
Right. There are lots of challenges in our politics at the moment. There are lots of challenges that the government face.
What was it convinced you that Brexit was so bad for Britain?
I set out my reasons for deciding that we should, on balance, stay within the European Union. I voted to remain, I campaigned to remain.
And when did you change your mind?
The British people were given the choice, and the British people decided that they wanted the United Kingdom to leave the European Union.
So you're now stuck with trying to deliver something you believe is bad for this country.
I'm delivering what I believe the British people want their government to deliver. And I think it's very important. I think it's not just an issue about Brexit itself. It's actually an issue, to me, about trust in politicians.
But you said in March last year that we will be more secure, more prosperous and more influential, virtually in those words, if we stayed in the European Union. And now you want to take us out of it.
And I also said that the sky wouldn't fall in if we left the European Union.
So you have changed your mind.
We gave people the choice.
You changed your mind.
I'll answer that in a minute. We gave people the choice, Jeremy, and the British people decided to leave the European Union. Yeah. And I think it's important for them to see their politicians delivering on that choice and respecting the will of the people. Oh, well, I think
so. So you changed your mind.
What I am now doing is...
Have you changed your mind?
I think there are huge opportunities.
Have you changed your mind?
Jeremy, I know that you have used this tactic and you want...
I'm just trying to get an answer. Yes. That's all. Yes. You can say yes or no.
So I let it play on there because it goes on into that. It starts out with this compound loaded question and then it descends into this slippery set of questions that ends up with him just insisting that he tells her whether or not she's changed her mind, and she tries even to confront him with this like well-known tactic, and he dismisses her entirely. Very irritating. So apologies to anyone who had to watch it the first time round. Obviously I'm frustrated having to watch it so many times. Okay, good. So yeah, leading questions, once again, not always bad questions, but bad when they prevent or impede epistemic progress, and in particular, that's often when they're worded in, well, they are always worded in such a way that a particular answer is favoured over others. And again, in a trial of deposition, leading questions can be objected to the opposing by the opposing party, as the cartoon illustrates. So questions like, for example, how fast were the cars going when they hit each other versus how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, or how fast were the cars going when they bumped into each other. And those different questions have been shown to produce different results with respect to how the respondent estimates speed. If it's smashed, they tend to estimate faster. If it's bumped, they'll estimate slower. And these are particularly problematic. Hopefully, the psychologists in the room certainly will recognise that leading questions are particularly problematic in a research survey context. They're also problematic in public discourse, especially in the context of major referendum, for example. So the referendum on Scottish independence had an issue with the wording of the question. The original question, do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country, was judged to be leading. Because it looked like it would probably favour yes. So it got changed to should Scotland be an independent country. Same thing happened with the UK referendum on EU membership. Should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union, again, might lead the respondent more naturally to say yes. And so that got changed. One example that I found where the question didn't get changed, which was very clearly leading, the New Zealand corporal punishment referendum in 2009... should a smack as part of good parental correction be a criminal offence in New Zealand? That was the actual question. And as a result, of course, the law wasn't changed on whether or not you can smack your children in New Zealand. Okay, so finally, the wrong question. I won't talk too much about this because I'm running out of time, but also because there's quite a lot to say about what it takes to... ask the wrong question, or what is involved in asking the wrong question. If you can see this is just an example where CNN basically were discussing a question that was asked by the founder of the alt-right movement, are Jews people? And they're discussing the fact that the question was asked. The fact that the question was asked is clearly a fairly clear instance, I think, of the wrong question, but it's also some of the comments that CNN sort of received and the way that it was misinterpreted in the comment sections demonstrates how not only the asking of the question but the reporting of the question has led in this case to a lot of confusion. Some of the people watching thought that the CNN was asking this question, or the people in the, you know, sitting behind the banner were asking this question and were really angry about that. Some of the people were questioning the use of the alt-right label in that sentence and so on. So that's just a kind of one case. This is another case that I found. Is there no one left in Britain who can make a sandwich front page news in the Daily Mail? And of course, it's front page news because the implication is like, because the story is about Marks and Spencer's in Tesco recruiting staff in Hungary. So it's immigrant labour, whatever. I don't think they're even actually in the UK. They're actually in Hungary. But I'm not really sure how to characterise that question, but there's definitely something wrong with it. especially when it's the front page. So I kind of just put that out there to see if you have any response to how that could be put into the taxonomy. But at the moment, it looks to me at least like the wrong question. Okay, so finally, I'd like to look at the conditions under which this kind of bad questioning arises. And I'm drawing very heavily on Dr. Ian Kidd's work on corrupting epistemic corruption. And so thinking just about the ways in which we can have bad questioning arises or some of the reasons why it does, I think it's largely to do with the fact that bad questioning is rewarded or given prominence in a society, that good questioning is not highly valued, that good questioning is not well understood as a practice, that questioning itself is not valued or understood as a practice, and that answers are valued above all, at all costs, above questions, so that it doesn't matter what questions are asked, as long as we have answers, then we can report them, sort of thing. So the Paxman case, I think, is really clear illustration of these corrupting conditions. So Paxman's bad questioning is not only rewarded and given prominence, it's a large part of how he made his name and how he maintains his reputation, although admittedly it did suffer after those interviews. Paxman himself doesn't appear to value good questioning, at least according to what we see there. The media outlets that employ him don't appear to value good questioning, again, because of what we kind of see in those cases, and he epitomises this ruthless pursuit of answers, regardless of the questions. I think there are also pragmatic and environmental constraints that might lead to bad questioning, and also some accepted norms. So, particularly in the context of academic Q&As, and I don't want to make my pass for the chair, but I do think there are ways in which academic Q&As can engender bad questioning practices, in particular with respect to this kind of joke that a lot of people make to me when I talk about this, about, you know, we'd now like to open the floor to short speeches disguised as questions. And people say that happens a lot in these contexts. I think it does, but I do think there are like structural reasons for that, because normally when you engage in a question and answer exchange, you are able to have two or three or four or a whole hour long discussion. And in this context, you have to ram everything that you want to say into one question, knowing that probably it's not going to get understood the first time round, and then you're not going to have a shot at responding again. So you don't get that kind of exchange. And I think that's what might lead to this kind of problem. Some hope, well, there are ways in which people are held accountable. These are some of the comments that were put up during and after the Paxman debate, I do think that the more that people are held to account for bad questioning in public discourse, the better, and also ultimately educating for the skills involved in good questioning is what will sort of remove this problem, or resolve this problem to some extent in the long run.